Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A brief a priori apology to listeners today. If I sound a bit coarse of voice, it is just because we are recording this a few days after the 2015 NFC Championship game, and you could say that I'm being penalized for excessive celebration. Okay, well, now on with the show. My guest today is Ken Coleman, the Frederick G.L. Hewitt Well Professor of Political Science and the incoming director of the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan. He is the principal investigator of the Constituency Level Elections Archive, which is famous for being the largest repository of election data results in the world. In addition to being a data guy for the Wolverines, he has authored a number of journal articles and books, including Outside Lobbying, Public Opinion and Interest Group Strategies, The American Political System, The Formation of National Party Systems, Federalism and Party Competition in Canada, Great Britain, India, and the United States, co-authored with a previous graduate schoolmate of mine, Pradeep Chipper, and most recently, Perils of Centralization, Lessons from Church, State, and Corporation. This latter book is the topic of our conversation today, and as usual, you can find links to these works and other neat stuff back at our webpage. Ken, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. So, my understanding is you know Pradeep.
I do. I do know Pradeep. He was the first contact I ever had when I went to UCLA to investigate that school for possible graduate studies. And I think he was a year or two ahead of me in the graduate program. And as I'm walking through the halls of Bunch Hall there on UCLA campus, I meet him and I say, "Oh, hi, I'm Tony." And he says, "Yeah, I'm Pradeep. I'm a graduate student here." And I said, "Oh, how do you like it?" He goes, "This is the most miserable experience I've ever had. It's just so oppressive." And I was like, "Oh, crap, this is probably not the best way to start things out." But it turned out that He's an incredible guy, very inspirational. He's a hard worker and one of the best scholars out there. So it was good having him, not necessarily in my cohort, but around my cohort at that time. So glad to see that you're working with that fine scholar.
He's a wonderful man, and yes, he's a great scholar, and I'm not surprised by his honesty about what graduate school is like.
If he's anything, it is honest. I mean, that is one thing, and it was good because it set the standards low for me, and then everything else was just really good after that. So, but we're here to talk about your book, "The Perils of Centralization: Lessons from Church, State, and Corporation," and this is a book that one would not necessarily think would be fodder for a show that is largely on the social scientific study of religion, given that it includes a wide array of comparative cases from the United States government and the European Union to General Motors, maker of fine automobiles. Nonetheless, you toss in an examination of the Catholic Church, which is really what caught my attention here. And I have to stand up and strongly applaud you for something that you write in the chapter on the church, because it is something that I have been saying to my colleagues for some 20 years now, but you put it really succinctly. So if I may, I'm going to read it to folks, the first sentence here in that chapter. You write, quote, "By some measures, the largest and oldest organization in the world, the Roman Catholic Church, the church hereafter, is a marvel of endurance as well as a fascinating case of institutional evolution." And I say, exactly. I have had so many fellow scholars dismiss the study of religion as something epiphenomenal in politics, but here we have this gargantuan formal institution, which some might say has roughly a billion citizens or adherents, and it's outlasted, as you point out, every existing government or state, yet somehow us political scientists thinks it's irrelevant. I go figure on that one. And I tell my colleagues that there might be something that we can learn from this, looking at the perseverance of that entity. And you take a great big step towards applying the concepts and tools of political science to look at that question. So let me ask you this. You're not necessarily a scholar who picked up religion to begin your career with. What pushed you to think about this book in general and the Catholic Church in particular?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I was interested in the evolution of organizations towards either direction, centralization or decentralization initially, and there's lots of possibilities there. I was interested in big important ones that people would care about, and so I did a lot of reading on a variety of these kinds of, you know, systems or institutions, whatever you want to call them. I did a lot of reading on, for example, the Holy Roman Empire in Germany. I did a lot of reading on the AFL-CIO. I did a lot of reading on the Iroquois Federation and Confederation, the nation of the nations of Iroquois. I did a lot of reading on the Roman Empire. The thing about the church that's fascinating to me is, became fascinating to me, is that it had this somewhat back and forth for many centuries of power between the bishops and the papacy. But that at some point it seemed to switch into a mode which is consistent with my other cases, where you know, power within the institution trended in the direction of the executive, and so it fit very well the overall argument that I'm making. It also helps that there's a tremendous literature on, you know, both secondary literature but also primary sources. If you go to the church documents, it's all available for you. There's quite a bit of consensus among historians about the broader patterns of church history in terms of the relationship between the papacy and the bishops. Of course, they disagree about, you know, specifics, but the broader trend is you know, I'm not going to get in any hot water talking about the strengthening of the papacy over time in the last 200 years. This is quite well accepted by historians of the church. So it fit. It's fascinating. It's important. It's understudied by political scientists, which is exactly what you've just said. And it offers an absolutely fascinating example of precisely the phenomenon I argue is actually common among institutions with the same setup.
We'll get to that argument in a second, but I want to explore your examination of the church or your decision to examine the church even more. I'm somebody who is absolutely fascinated by what many people call apples and oranges comparisons, because I believe you can compare apples and oranges. And what you just mentioned, you said that you'd done reading on the Roman Empire and the Iroquois Confederation. And that could be a second book. I'd be buying that one right away, because that sounds really interesting if you dug into those cases even deeper. But the comparison that you did, and when you're shopping this book manuscript around and you're attending conferences and you're presenting papers and talking to your other colleagues about these ideas, did you get any pushback or people raising an eyebrow saying, well, you're comparing the Catholic Church with General Motors or the Catholic Church with the European Union? What's the deal here, man?
Yeah, I think that is the initial reaction of some people. I think as I draw them into the argument, I think there's, you know, a kind of aha moment by them that I see what you're talking about. There's a lot of interest in the papacy, especially in the last few years. And one of the advantages I have, it's partly a disadvantage, but it's mostly an advantage, is quite a few people who study organizations and political science in general, of the sociology of organizations, don't know much about the history of the Catholic Church. So they're going to be interested just in general in the narrative, but that my purpose is not to give a definitive narrative, but rather to draw themes out of that narrative that connect with the other cases. But you're right that there, initially people are thinking, these are apples and oranges. But as you present the argument, I think people have been quite, open to the notion that this comparison is useful.
That kind of comparison always does draw people in when you catch them off guard. A lot of our profession is dedicated to replicating the same studies with maybe little the modifications on theories here and there on the same institutions over and over again. And when you throw in something that people are not used to talking about, it does grab their attention. And as you said, at first they're like, I don't know. But then there is that aha moment. And I've had the same thing with some of my other colleagues. They say, you know what? That is kind of interesting. We sit here and think about how states persevere over time, but we never really realize that the Roman Catholic Church is a governing institution that's lasted a really, really long time. So,
yeah, and let me say that, there a long time ago, about 50 years ago, political science was, and political science concepts were very central to the study of organizations. That hasn't necessarily been the case in recent decades. I think that political science has a set of tools, conceptual tools, methodological tools, that are useful to the study of governance in general across, realms, as small as, university committees and to as large as, the church or the world's largest corporations. But we're reluctant as political scientists. We're often reluctant to do that, to take those concepts and tools and methods outside of the study of nation states or outside of the study of democratic politics or something like that. But I'm not afraid to do this. I think it's important to say that we have a set of concepts, tools, methods that translate and that can help, help broadly people understand governance in general.
And you do a great job doing that. One of the other interesting aspects of your book is that it's rather confessional, if I can use that word, especially in the opening of your introductory chapter. And not many scholars do what you did, but you revealed that you are a practicing Catholic that has a brother who is a priest. And most social scientists are not that open about that background. So what gives with this? And did your publisher raise an eyebrow when you put that in there? And they said, well, maybe you should take that out.
It was a topic of conversation between the editor at Cambridge Press and me. He ended up buying my argument. It was actually suggested by the editor of another press that was considering the book and was interested in the book as well. And that editor of the other press thought that readers would want to know, do I have any personal attachment to any of these institutions, especially General Motors, I'm at Michigan, and the church, I'd like to think, and I, it's something to strive for, I'd like to think that in terms of the overall research and the conclusions drawn, that my own personal beliefs and practices are irrelevant to those. But I do think, I ended up convincing the editor at Cambridge Press that readers might find it interesting, this background of mine, if you want to call it that, but again, it wasn't to say anything to prejudice the reader in any way about, one way or another on the validity of my conclusions. It was partly to kind of, clear the air a little bit about, because the Catholic Church has certainly, especially since the child sexual abuse scandals of the last decade that have come to light, you know, there's sometimes an emotional response to talking about Catholicism, and I don't want to, you know, make too much of that, but I do want to say, you know, I'm interested in studying the church as an organization and institution and how it governs itself, and I don't want to make any normative claims in the context of the research findings about, you know, whether it's good or bad that it's centralized, whether it's good or bad that it's endured. You know, I want to think of it as a little bit of a laboratory to study the phenomenon that we care about.
I found what you did there to be really refreshing, because as I've done these podcasts over the years, one of the things that I like to do is get to know a little bit about the background of the scholar and what pushed them into the topic or pulled them into the topic, because that's as fascinating as the topic itself sometimes. And so I really do applaud you for that confessional aspect of the book. The other thing I thought about too when I was reading this is that, well, you said your brother was a priest. I'm wondering, from one of those feudal aristocracy families there that, you know, the first son gets to be the chairman of General Motors, and then the second son goes into the military, the third son is the priest, and then finally when you get down to the fourth son, you got to become a political scientist.
Yeah, well, yeah, I had to, you know, kind of pick up the scraps. No, my brother is the oldest, and in the family, we have another sister, so there's three of us. He when he was about a teenager, my parents, you know, kind of thought, who can we sell him off to? So the local bishop kind of did highest. But no, he actually entered college thinking he was going to be a doctor and changed his mind in college and felt called. So,
well, he is a doctor of the soul, you could
say.
One
of my best friends and a great, great person.
Big shout out to your brother there. So let's get into your argument now. Your book is principally about centralization, and you discuss the historical tendency for decentralized polities, be they governments, corporations, religious groups, whatever, to concentrate power in the executive over time. Give us a sense of what your general theory or ideas are here.
Yeah, so the domain of analysis here is the federated institutions, and these are ones that essentially have subunits that are, in and of themselves capable in principle of organizing their life and practices on their own, but they're part of this larger federated institution. The story in the book, or the trend that I am describing, that I describe as typical for such organizations, is that when they have an executive authority that is instituted by the subunits, the subunits themselves, well, I shouldn't say if, when over time the subunits themselves tend to lose their representation at the central level, what happens over time is that the executive becomes more and more detached from the subunit. I'm not saying this right. That the subunits themselves lose their representation over time in causing the executive to be constrained in taking actions. And so, essentially, the story is that there's a loss of subunit representation in governance at the central level, and executives exploit that over time, and the end result is that the executive is able to, in three ways, create a locked-in situation where they can prevent decentralization back to the subunits. And so the executives, the first way they do is they create a bureaucracy around themselves such that the that bureaucracy becomes the natural place for the work of the entire Federation to occur, and the expectation is among the subunits that that bureaucracy is where that work should occur. Second, the executive ends up monopolizing the interpretation of centralization and decentralization questions. So if there's some controversy or dispute over where authority should lie on a given question, that the executive has, over time, increasingly inordinate influence on the interpretation of those questions. So in the United States, we say things like, in American government, we say things like, you know, the federal question or questions about federal power. Well, the story there is that the office of the presidency and the executive end up having disproportionate influence on the moments when the interpretation happens. That is, and that happens through the Supreme Court in the United States government. But in the church, what ends up happening is the papacy, they codify that the Pope is the final authority on, and this is really important, executive, legislative, and judicial authority within the church. So he becomes the final arbiter of where authority ought to lie. Well, guess what, right? You know, when there's a dispute, where's authority going to land? It's going to land in the office of the papacy. And then finally, the executive amasses resources such that when there's a challenge to that central power, those resources can be used to divide and conquer the subunits, to keep them divided and not united enough to challenge central power. So bureaucracy, interpretive power, and resources to divide and conquer the subunits when there are challenges. And that those three things enable the executive to lock in authority at the executive level and prevent a true decentralization. And by true decentralization, I mean, you know, where power flows back to the subunits, and they emerge with more autonomy than they had prior, to a prior date. So that's a long answer to your question, but that's the basic argument.
And if you follow the trajectory of many institutions, including our own universities, you tend to see that process always at work here. And it's interesting because you start with federations and places that are decentralized at the local grassroots entities, organizations, governments have a great deal more power. But over time, there is a centralization, as you just described. For me, the fascinating question is how, in many respects, the local units actually agree to this. And you have this process, this five-stage process, which you eventually get into the executive lock-in, and it goes through assent and representative centralization, partisanship, which is a very interesting aspect of this whole theory, then the executive centralization and lock-in. Walk us through those five stages.
Yeah, assent. So assent is when the subunits assent to be part of a union, a common entity. And what they're really assenting to, most of the time, certainly this was the case with, for example, the American states into the United States, certainly the case with the countries of Europe into the European Union, is they assent to what I'm calling representative centralization, which is that they agree on centralized power, but that the subunits themselves would have a continuing voice in not only policy decisions that are made at the central level, but in the decisions over which kinds of policy decisions would be made at the central level and which kinds would be made at the subunit level. So there's specific policy questions. You know, what should the speed limit be in the states, right? And then there's the meta question of who should decide what the speed limit should be in the states. And in the states, the subunits themselves are assenting to the notion that, you know, we're gonna join together, we're gonna be a union, we're gonna be one together, but we're going to maintain our representation in a well understood process by which we make decisions, these meta federal decisions, these decisions about where authority will lie.
And a lot of that makes sense too, because there are some advantages to this centralization. The case that you use with the United States makes a lot of sense. Early on, we tried a confederation, and it was just a mess. Everybody's printing their own currencies. They're taxing each other across state lines. And everybody says, you know, we'd be all better off if we just had some kind of umbrella organization that we could yield some authority to. And yeah, it sounds pretty good. But again, the states say, hey, we want to keep some of our autonomy here, some of our power.
Right. Now, the partisanship is really a key part of this story, and by partisanship I don't necessarily mean in the you know, political parties in ordinary politics. By partisanship I mean that people in the subunits and throughout the federated institution have identities and/or they conceptualize their interests in terms of issues that are at stake at the central level. So they begin to think about who's with them and who's not with them, who are my, you know, opponents, in terms of central issues. And so one of the natural consequences of uniting into a federation and having this representative centralization is that you see this creation of these kind of groupings around central issues that divide people. So when federations have devised a system with a separate executive, as we do in the United States, we have a presidential system where the president is chosen separately from the representative body, the Congress. And many organizations have that, where the executive is chosen by a separate board, by investors or something. You know, they're not chosen by the subunit representatives. They're not accountable directly to the subunit representatives. When an institution or when a federation has a separate executive, that's where you have the possibility of a tipping, if you will, into executive centralization. And what ends up happening, and this happened in the church very much, is that executive ends up exploiting differences among the subunits. It exploits moments of crisis when the subunits feel threatened, when there's a serious threat of secession and so forth. They exploit those moments to say, hey, you know, you need a strong leader to resolve this crisis. And in order for me to be a strong leader and resolve the crisis that's in your interest to resolve, you need to give me these resources. You need to give me more bureaucracy. You need to give me resources to do what I need to do, whatever it is.
Let me pause you there a minute, because I have an interesting question that might help fill some of this out too. And I was wondering this as I was reading your book and thinking about not only the Catholic Church, but the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and a few other places as well. Is there a sense, too, that career paths matter? I mean, you think in the United States, your springboard to becoming eventually a U.S. congressional representative or senator or even president starts at the local level, maybe municipal city council or maybe a state representative. And then, you know, you jump up to the next level. And if your career trajectory is aimed at that higher central aspect, is there a willingness to maybe assent a little bit more to greater control by the central authority? Because you know, you at some point in time, you're going to be in D.C., and boy, wouldn't it be kind of cool to have that power? Or even just to get appointed up there, you need the guiding finger or you know, somebody, a mentor who will bring you up through those channels.
Absolutely. That's a very important point, and I think it's a spot on. When subunit leaders, and you can think of prominent priests or bishops in the church, you know, are ambitious, and I don't use ambition in a negative way. I mean, they could, you know, ambition to do good things, you know, make the world a better place. I mean, but when they're ambitious, and part of that ambition entails, you know, climbing a ladder to higher parts of an organizational hierarchy, you know, they're going to have an eye on what's happening at the central level, and they're going to be thinking about, you know, where do I sit relative to the current leader of that central unit? And so, you know, in the church, you know, I think it's, you know, the history of a lot of the divisions among the bishops going back centuries and millennia, actually, are differences among groups of bishops, among, you know, even entire countries of bishops in their relationship to the current pope, the positions of the pope, the decisions that, you know, the pope is making relative to the other, you know, challenges on his power, either within the church or outside of the church. So a classic example is the French bishops, for, you know, really since you know, the 1500s, have had a, you know, very much a fraught relationship with the papacy, partly because they had a Catholic king, and you know, their loyalties between the two were very, and within the French clergy, there was tremendous division between those who were more loyal to the pope versus more loyal to the French king, and these kinds of, you know, they were not only just about raw power between the two, but also real policy questions that had to do with, you know, the relationship to Protestantism and the relationship to, you know, other parts of the world and so forth.
So this partisanship aspect is really a key driver, and that is underlying a lot of the dynamics of your model here. But you also mentioned the role of crises. And are there any particular crises that matter for executive centralization? Is it a threat from outside? Is it turmoil within the polity or at the local levels? Do you see any patterns about how crises might matter in these situations?
Yeah, I think to qualify as a crisis in my story, it has to be a situation where everyone agrees that there is an urgent problem that needs addressing. In the, you know, and that the church, for example, needs to make collective decisions to deal with it. In the, you know, certainly the, you know, the threat from the Protestant Reformation was extremely important to the evolution of the church, you know, for several centuries. The focus of the book on the church is mostly in the 19th and 20th century, and a lot of the crises there, there's several, but the main overarching crisis is the church's relationship to the modern world and the relationship to science, to liberalism, to democracy, to secular government, to, you know, later to the role of women in society. But it, you know, the church has struggled for, you know, since early 19th century with the, you know, these very large global trends that have challenged its fundamental tenets, and it's changed a lot. In, you know, I mean, it's, you know, there was a moment when the church opposed democracy and opposed voting and republicanism, small r republicanism, and you know, science and any notion of understanding, you know, Darwin's evolution or something that could actually be a real depiction of biological processes. I mean, the church was adamantly opposed to all that at various points in its history. It's done a 180 on many of those things. You know, but the crisis aspect of it is that everyone, no matter what their prescribed solution is, which would that they disagree about, they all agree it's a crisis and something needs to be done. And so that these kind of these crises are moments when subunits look towards the center for guidance, solution, guidance, figure, you know, and they of course try to influence what the center's doing. But the key is that the crisis is these moments when executives are often given additional resources and authority. And then the question is, do they give it back? And often no. I mean, this is one of the major stories in a lot of these institutions is executives get these resources, they get this additional authority, and it stays there long after the crisis is over, or long after, at least, if the crisis isn't completely over, at least there's some kind of institutional resolution of how the Federation is going to deal with this.
And that's what you're talking about, the executive centralization and the padding of the bureaucracy around it, becoming the central authority on the decisions of who will be the central authority in the eventual lock-in. The question that I have about lock-in sounds like such a tipping point or a point of no return. Is that what you're talking about here? What is a lock-in exactly?
Well, so lock-in really means that it would be very, very unusual to go backward, and that to go backward would require, extraordinary events and effort, to reverse course and go in a more decentralized direction. So, I mean, you don't want to say the word never, like the church will never decentralize, never is kind of strong, but it's kind of like the forces of gravity. I mean, all the pressures are downward. All the pressures in this case are upward, right? I mean, you need to do something very special, create a new set of institutions or something to reverse course. Now, part of the lock-in that I'm arguing here is in contrast to other kinds of forms of governance, and in particular in the nation-state realm, I'm thinking of parliamentary governments. There are countries, and the two that I'm quite familiar with from previous work, Canada and India have actually decentralized quite a bit over the over the last 25 to 30 years. And it's been real decentralization, and my argument is that those countries, the executive is directly accountable to the representatives from the subunits, and in political science we call that fused government, which means that the executive and the representative body are fused together. You don't have a separation of power of character to it. My argument is that when separation of powers kinds of institutions centralize to this executive form of centralization, they get locked in, whereas in contrast, organizations, governments, institutions that have where the executive is accountable directly to the subunits on a day-to-day basis, they have much more flexibility, and so they are not locked in. So, one of the things I try to argue in the book is that, the best examples we have from political science of true decentralization that has been very consequential are in forms of governance that are not this separate, that don't have the separation of powers character to it. So lock-in is really a way to say, if you're gonna set up your governance the way the United States has and the Catholic Church has and so forth, you're gonna have this centralization that's gonna be too much towards the executive, and it's gonna be very difficult, if not impossible, to move the other direction without tremendous disruption.
Hmm. Okay, well, we're going to talk about decentralization near the end, and I want to see if there's counter trends, and you've given us a little bit of taste about it. But I do want to start talking about the Catholic Church, and you've already touched upon it and have told us about the scope of your study, which you begin in the mid-19th century or so, about the 1850s. But I have to admit that when I was reading your book, I couldn't help thinking about the early church history. The first 300 years of Christian history was very decentralized. And then you have the Edict of Milan, and then followed by the First Council of Nicaea. And you see this centralizing trend in the early to mid-300s. It just seems to really suggest a great case study for your thesis. And I'm wondering why you didn't decide to look at that era, or even the, in your book too, I have to admit, you do talk about some of the ebbs and flows of centralization and decentralization throughout the medieval period. But why do you pick the scope starting in the 1850s?
Yeah, I could have done the early period. The interesting, well, 1850s to now is a time frame where the ideas about democracy, about governance, about the appropriate roles for subunits within a federated institution were, there was a global lexicon. There was a terminology and a conceptual framework that comes out of the Enlightenment that makes such that the actor, the people within the church who are parts of these discussions and conversations and eventually conflicts and decisions, are themselves very familiar with. So the concepts, there's these concepts in the church. There's this notion of subsidiarity, which is a fancy word that just means power should be at the local level, if at all possible, and only by necessity at a higher level. That's actually a notion that's in church documents as a guiding principle of church governance. They talk about collegiality, which is very much a notion that has elements of kind of separation of powers to it. That the notion of collegiality within the church is that the Pope and the bishops co-govern the church, that they're not in a hierarchical relationship to each other, although that's one interpretation of collegiality. So these are terms in the church that that suggest a kind of a set of conceptual tools that people were are playing with and trying to use in real conversations about institutional reform. And so the mid-19th century to now is a period in which the players themselves were aware of the very issues that I'm addressing in this book. Whether that was true in the first three or four centuries of the church, I don't know, and I can't. It seems like the history, as you say, conforms pretty well. One of the things that I know that happened in that early period is, there were, they had to settle how powerful the Bishop of Rome was going to be relative to the other bishops, and there was conflict over that. And but again, they faced a crisis. They had a heresy, right? So, or these various heresies, and they knew they had to deal with the heresy. Well, who was going to make the decisions? But again, it isn't clear to me in the same way that it is in the last two centuries. It isn't clear to me that they had a common set of concepts that they were playing with. I just wouldn't know, and maybe the record can't, there's not enough evidence of the record, because it's so long ago and the records are spotty. I'm just not so kind of punting on your question a little bit.
Well, that's fine, because then we can have a punt receiver who would be a budding young graduate student out there looking for a dissertation topic. I think it would be absolutely fantastic to apply some of these ideas out there and really really extend the study beyond the 1850s. And you hint at it, and it's just absolutely great. And the other thing too, you have to choose a time frame because there are two types of books. There are finished books and unfinished books, and it's always good to have the finished kind. So walk us through this history from the 1850s and through the process of centralization that you see, because there's a couple big events here, most notably Vatican I and Vatican II occurred during this period of time. So what goes on? What do the 1850s look like to begin with, and then how do we start to see change in the institution during this period?
So the church and the central church, meaning the people governing the church, the bishops and the pope, are really very much a part of the turmoil of Europe of the 19th century, and that turmoil is the status of republicanism versus monarchy, and the coming to terms with ideas of freedom of religion, coming out of the religious wars of the earlier centuries, is there going to be religious tolerance, and can democracy survive on the continent? This is the church is right in the midst of that. And to make in the beginning of the period, the church and the pope himself, controls territory. It has secular power as well as ecclesiastical power. And he owns the papal states and has access to resources that they're kind of like a among the monarchs of Europe. Obviously in tension with many of them, tremendous tension. So what happens over, about a pretty quickly in historical terms, but it happens over several decades in the mid-19th century, is that the Pope and the central church governing unit, if you want to call it that, the Curia and the Pope, go from having, some secular authority as one of the monarchs of Europe, to having virtually no secular authority at all. So loses the papal states in the Italian wars and the eventual creation of the Italian monarchy or republic and then monarchy, while at the same time his theological authority or his ecclesiastical authority is on the ascendancy, is on the way up. So in some ways the way to think about it is that secular authority of the papacy drops almost to nothing, and ecclesiastical authority within the church goes way up to the point where by Vatican I he has enough support from bishops in key countries, especially Italy and Spain, to declare that he has he has infallible authority on certain issues of dogma, that the Pope is the final authority on documents that are the final authority for the church that apply everywhere. So the church, the papacy, all of a sudden gets more theologically ambitious in the 19th century, at the very moment when it's becoming secularly irrelevant. Okay, these are related and not independent things. Vatican I is very much a part of that. Now, Vatican I is occurring in a time of turmoil in Europe, in Italy in particular. But a lot of the context for Vatican I is the church, the clergy in Europe, the bishops and the priests in the orders in Europe are coming to terms with liberalism, with push towards republicanism, democracy, new scientific discovery. They're coming to terms with all of these aspects of modernity, some of that, those ideas have threads of democracy, ideas about democracy that are a direct threat to papal authority. I mean, the notion that, it's a pretty good idea to govern where you actually distribute power among, various people so that, you don't have abuses of power. I mean, this is a kind of, comes out of the American Revolution, comes out of the French Revolution, comes out of the Enlightenment in general. These ideas were very popular among even certain clergy in France and Germany. So Vatican I is called by the Pope, and he has some support from this group of French bishops called Ultramontanists to kind of settle some of these questions. Now, they didn't settle it completely, Vatican I, but they did declare this papal infallibility, and that's in that context.
Yeah, this is the era, I should say, that papal infallibility is institutionalized or codified. And many people think it goes back even farther, but what you just said really taps something in my mind here that I hadn't thought about before, is that your story about centralization is not centralization writ large, but here's an interesting case wherein some of the authority of the central power of the Curia, of the Pope, is being lost. Wars of Italian states, you lose your secular authority, and in the process, and this could be one of the crises you're talking about, we're really going to bolster authority in the other area, the one area that we have left over, and that is in religious spiritual affairs or within specifically our own organization.
Right. I mean, a lot of it is, these deals, these concordats that the Vatican, the Rome, and then the Vatican agreed to with governments of the most important countries, where basically a lot of the questions were over who could name bishops, like who could say this is the bishop of that diocese, who would have that authority? Was it the king, who happened to be Catholic, right, the Spanish or Italian king, or was it the Pope or the Vatican? What to do with the resources of the church, upon the death of someone, a bishop, or how were resources and land to be distributed within territories that were not under the control of the Pope? So a lot of these questions, the Pope. I mean, the representatives of the Pope and the Pope himself kind of is a long process of negotiation with these governments, and where it ended up often was, the Pope kind of winning some of this, right? Well, I'll be able to name bishops, right? But you will have the you are able to, for example, incorporate church lands into local zoning regulations, right, over land use and things like this. So it's kind of a give and take there, but where it ended up was, on church ecclesiastical matters, Rome won some concessions from these governments, but on secular governmental matters, basically the national governments are taking it away from the church in dramatic fashion.
So what occurs now between Vatican I and Vatican II? Vatican II is another interesting landmark in church history, and it seems like it's a decompression time. And I would want to know what is going on here in relation to your thesis. Many people would say, well, this seems to be a decentralization of papal authority. Is it or is it not? And what's happening there?
Well, Vatican II was many things, a very complicated, complex council over many years, over several years. It certainly, did have this tremendous effect of opening up the church to the modern world, and the church is coming to terms with the international human rights regime, and it's coming out of world, fascism and World War II had this tremendous effect on the church that you know, it kind of came to terms with the dangers of you know, authoritarian government, and the dangers of, you know, some of its anti-Semitism and racism that are certainly part of the church's past. And then lots of other things, coming to terms with the role of women in society and the spread of the church, or the coming to terms with the cultural differences across the globe, you know, in incorporating Latin American and African and Asian cultural forms into the liturgy and so forth.
Yeah, and priests could wear blue jeans.
And priests could wear blue jeans.
Yeah,
so,
it was okay to do.
So lots of changes happening in Vatican II. For my purposes, Vatican II was trying to clean up some of what was left undone at Vatican I, which is the relationship between the bishops and the papacy and the governance of the church. And the story of Vatican II is I think, at least better known than the story of Vatican I. But you know, the bishops themselves, the first pope that was part of Vatican I, John the 23rd, seemed very open to changes, and actually permitted the council to make, you know, doctrinal decisions by vote of the bishops, and didn't seem to play a heavy hand in any vetoing or you know, steering the agenda in his direction or anything like that. It seemed very. But then, of course, he dies midway through the council. Paul VI appears to be doing something similar, but then towards the end of the council, there's this, you know, one of the documents of the Vatican II is talking about collegiality and what that means, which is, you know, this relationship between the bishops and the pope and who governs the church, and collegiality has some meaning, you know, is interpreted by some in one of the, you know, as coming out of that particular document, Lumen Gentium, that, you know, the pope and the bishops co-govern, and that's the interpretation of collegiality. Well, the pope, after being pressured or at least confronted by a group of conservative bishops, writes an appendix, or you know, he thought it was going to be an introductory part, but it ended up as an appendix of that document, which says, hey, wait, you know, what this means, what my understanding of collegiality means, and what this is going to be the understanding of the church of collegiality is that the bishops govern the church with the pope at the head of the bishops and is the final authority on matters of church governance, on matters of doctrinal, you know, anything doctrinal. And so the pope kind of slams the door on a more separation of powers character to church governance. And this is, you know, a kind of moment, very clear moment, when the executive is showing the lock-in here. The executive is saying, you know, we're not going to open the door to, you know, a co-governing model, a representation of the subunits in final decision making. You know, the decision, you know, I am the final decision maker, or the person in my role is the final decision maker. So I think of Vatican II as, yes, it was a decompression might be one word. I mean, there were certain things that devolved the church. There was some devolution. That's a different than decentralization. It means that the units are permitted to take some autonomous decisions, but that permission can be revoked. You know, so a lot of that happened with Vatican II, but at the ultimate, you know, who has the final authority in the central government of the church? You know, the Pope slammed the door right in the 11th hour.
I want to ask you in our closing moments here about possibilities for decentralization in the future. And one of the interesting things about Catholic history is that there's always these movements that are countering some of the centralization or some of, you know, what people might consider to be corruption in the papacy. You get these monastic movements early on in the church history, and as well as different groups springing up, Opus Dei, liberation theology, a whole gamut of it. And the issue of liberation theology is also very interesting in terms of your study. Leonardo Boff, who is one of the Brazilian liberation theologians, and came under great fire by Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, it was all about this authority issue. I mean, a lot of people hear this issue between Ratzinger and Leonardo Boff and think, well, Ratzinger really hates the poor because Boff is talking about the poor. But really, at its core, it was a debate about central authority within the institution. And Boff was basically calling for a radical decentralization of the church. What are the prospects for decentralization in these centralizing organizations writ large, or perhaps more specifically from your vantage point to the Catholic Church? Are we likely to see continued centralization, or what might be some processes that lead to devolution or decentralization?
Yeah, I think the pattern you see in the church is that there's, you know, the notion of subsidiarity that I mentioned earlier is not completely irrelevant. I mean, there's a lot of tolerance of difference, and there's a lot of diversity in the church. So centralization doesn't mean uniformity everywhere. You know, the church, this is one of the things the church gets criticized a lot for, is it tolerates, you know, bishop says something crazy or does something offensive. And I mean, the church tolerates more than you would think given how centralized it is. But then it reveals the centralized character when it does step in, that it can step in, it can rein in, it can remove bishops, it can silence orders, silence theologians, it can, sanction orders, religious orders. So liberation theology, I think the different popes since it, you know, certainly John Paul II wasn't a fan. He tolerated up to a point, but then reined some things in. And let me just think in the abstract. If I tolerate something, that in and of itself implies that I have the authority to not tolerate it.
Mm.
Obviously, a bureaucracy and a pope in Rome can't control what happens all over the world. But they can take action at certain breaking points, and you see that. I mean, you see that, you know, at some point, you know, there's lines that are crossed, and it steps in, and it takes action. It does this. And, you know, the people that are involved, I mean, the theologians that have been silenced and the bishops that have been fired, I mean, they have a choice. They can say, well, I'm no longer part of the church, or I'm, you know, going to accept whatever, you know, punishment or sanction or whatever that's happened to me. Most of them do the latter, right? They accept, and they, you know, it's a little bit of passive aggressiveness, but I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way. I just mean that, you know, by necessity, given the scope of this enormous institution, there's a lot of tolerance for what goes on. But at some point, you know, the lasses come out and rein people in, when they really get out of order. So that, to me, is actually a sign that at the end of the day, the authority lies in Rome and in the papacy. To the church is very ambitious for, on certain theological, liturgical, ecclesiastical matters, to have conformity. On other things, it tolerates a lot. And at the edges is where you get, you know, is what makes the news, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me finish up with one question here, and there's a number of questions that we didn't really get to because of time, but I want to strongly recommend to scholars of religion who are interested in religious institutions or for graduate students that are out there sniffing for dissertation topics to give this book a real serious consideration, because there's so many different directions you can take this. You can look at it, Protestant organizations within Islam or other places. The applications just really, really suggest themselves. So very strong applaud for your book. I'm loving it. The book, though, was published in 2013, I think early 2013, and you got to have all the copy editing done by late 2012. And so this was before the election of the new pope and stepping down of Pope Benedict, and then now we have Pope Francis. And so this might be a little bit of an unfair question to you, because I don't know how closely you read L'Osservatorio Romano or any of the Vatican literature that comes out, but what are your thoughts on Pope Francis and what he is doing? He's in the news. He's, as we've had previous podcast here, he's really popular and he seems to be shaking things up. And from the vantage point of what you've learned over the course of doing this research, do you see him as moving in the same directions of centralization or bolstering that power or possibly making some changes that we might not expect?
Yeah, I think there's somewhat of a misreading about Francis. I do think he has intentions to reform aspects of the Curia and the Vatican. I think he believes that local churches and dioceses should have more say in the who becomes bishop than they did under previous popes, under his predecessors. So in that sense, if you take those things as some kind of devolution towards the subunits, then the reform of the Curia may, if you think that will lead to weakening the Curia, right? I'm not convinced it will. There's a difference between reforming it and weakening it. I think if people believe that what Francis is going to do is decentralize the church, I don't see much evidence that in the end of the day this is going to be a weaker papacy or a weaker central governance of the church. I think it might be different, and I think he intends to have an effect. One of the things my book talks about that we haven't touched on, which I'll just be brief because I know we're towards the end, is that many bishops themselves have a stake in having a strong Vatican, strong Rome. I mean, they benefit within their own realms by having it widely recognized that Rome is the final authority, because Roman authority flows through them, even though that's not theologically how it's supposed to be, but that's practically how it is.
Yeah, the old career trajectories.
That they benefit by that. Well, it's not just that they're thinking of ascending to being a cardinal, mm-hmm. and possibly pope. It's that their prestige and authority and legitimacy within their diocese rests in a good part from the fact that they are linked to this global, globally powerful church central authority. And so they don't have a lot of bishops have, support the idea of a very strong pope and very strong pope and a very strong Vatican and a very strong centralized church. So the question is whose interest is it to really decentralize the church? That's not a question. It's a deep, long question that we can talk about. I think what Francis is doing is, in some ways, showing the power of the papacy. He's upsetting the deck chairs on the boat, and he's upsetting some people and making a lot of people happy. He's very popular. A lot of people want to see him succeed. At the end of the Francis papacy, are we going to see a dramatically decentralized church? I think not. I think that's unlikely, very, very, very unlikely.
Well, that is something that we will be watching for. And again, great topics for other scholars and for graduate students to be looking at. And Ken, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.